So we're all result of causes and conditions. We were all born into this world. We didn't get to pick our genes. We just said, oh, I'll have one of those and two of those, and I don't want that one. We have a particular set of parents that we didn't get to choose. We were born in a particular culture. Things have happened to us, and here we are. So can we respect that about each other? Respect all these differences, our uniqueness. And some of this uniqueness, I mean, I actually been teaching, I taught a class on karma and the end of karma last fall, and one of the things I tried to emphasize was that we all have different ways in, different ways of learning, different things that work for us. And we all behave in a different way, sometimes more skillfully than others because of things that happen to us. Some people have had trauma. They have a way of looking at the world that perhaps isn't the most harmonious way. And so could we look at each other that way? Could we look at everyone as a result of causes and conditions? That they really didn't have a whole lot of choice about this, we're the way we are. And could we bring kindness and compassion to ourselves and to each other? To realize that we are really perfect just the way we are. We couldn't be any other way. Rather than judging ourselves, judging others, striving to become something better. And can we actually see ourselves as processes rather than nouns, activities? And this, I'm going to have a talk about karma in a few moments, but Thich Nhat Hanh actually talks about looking at ourselves as energies playing out, not solid entities at all. So if we look at things this way, then perhaps we won't be so judgmental of ourselves and others. We could look at each other with a quality of kindness and compassion. This doesn't mean we don't hold ourselves and others responsible for their actions. We do it from a place of wisdom and compassion. As Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams said beautifully one evening, you have to love them and hold them responsible. And that's true for ourselves as well. So I think that points to a lot towards the way we want to kind of move in this practice, from a place of love and care rather than from some inner tyrant that tells you you need to try harder, but you never really can quite do that. So this sort of touches into the title of this talk this evening, what activates bright and dark karma. So what is karma? There's a lot of theories in the Buddha's time, and there's still a lot of theories about causality. But the Buddha focused on our actions, and in particular, actions of body, speech, and mind. And when I say mind, I'm talking about the conceptual quality of ourselves, the ability to think, plan, organize, think about the past and get all stirred up about it or project some future. So it's mind here I'm using as conceptual capability. It can be, and it's particularly about thoughts. So this can be internal thoughts as well as speech. And then finally, this other part, I should have said speech, actions of body, speech, and mind. So what I've been talking about is speech, internal, external speech. And then the last is mind, and in this case, we're talking about mind from a more Buddhist perspective, which maybe might be better called heart, this felt sense of things, how things feel to us. So we want to pay attention to these actions. We want to pay attention to our thought processes. We want to pay attention to what we say. And we want to pay attention to this felt sense and how it moves us. So this word karma, again, just actions of speech, body, and heart, I'll use that word. Karma, actually, the root meaning of it, the etymology of it, is to make. So what is it that's made? What are made are patterns of behavior. We act a certain way. The more and more we act that way, the more the inclination is to follow that behavior. So if you're angry and you just let your anger act out all the time, over and over again, that would be a tendency you will have. If you act from a place of kindness and compassion, that's a tendency that will get developed. So these patterns of behavior is what we perceive ourselves to be. We identify these patterns as, I'm a kind person, I'm an angry person, I'm a sad person. Where they're really habitual patterns of behavior that we've learned, not through any fault of our own, but because of causes and conditions in our life, we've learned, our culture, etc., we've learned to behave in a particular way. Does that make sense? So karma isn't something that the sense of self has. Karma isn't something that happens to you. Karma is what the sense of self is. The sense of identity is actually these patterns that have been created that we identify with. And so we can see ourselves rather than something solid as these dynamic processes. And what was unique about the way the Buddha looked at karma or causality is he focused on intention. Intention sometimes gets defined as the executive function, the capability we have to pull together all the whatever is necessary to act, to speak, to move our body. And intention, the most important part of karma is this heart sense, this felt sense, because that's what drives us. That's what activates speech, thought, mind, the way we use our body. So intention sometimes is called volition, a sense of willfulness. And this felt sense often gets triggered by a reflex reaction to whether an experience is pleasant or unpleasant. In Pali, the word is, or neutral. In Pali, the word is vedana, which sometimes gets translated as feeling. And then they start, well, that's not quite really, because it's not really an emotion. It's just a feeling tone. Or now, I guess it's become popular to use the term hedonic tone. It's just whether experience is pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. So this could be a sense experience. You could see something, really a beautiful sunset, and perhaps a pleasant sense feeling tone arises from that. Or maybe you're sick and your body aches and da-da, that's an unpleasant feeling tone. So it could also be an emotion. And actually, one of the reasons we tend not to like certain emotions is they have an unpleasant feeling tone. And it can be helpful, actually. I used to do this a lot. When I get caught up in some emotion, I just say, oh, this is unpleasant. So it kind of lowers the energy level a little bit just to say that. This person... Maybe someone says something that hurts your feelings, and you can get off into a story about it. But you might also just say, oh, what's really driving this whole reaction process is it feels unpleasant. When things are kind of neutral, don't have a lot of charge, the tendency is to try and stir something up. We kind of phase out Maybe you watch TV or something, or read all kinds of articles about stuff that really you don't need to read at all, and probably a lot of them create a lot of unpleasant feeling tone, especially if you read political articles. So a lot of things we do that are triggered by pleasant, unpleasant feeling tones isn't a moral problem, but where does it take you? Where does it take you to obsessively read things because you're not comfortable being with things not having a lot of excitement to them? What does it take for you to go veg out and watch TV? Where does that take you? It's also this quality of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral affects the way we respond to people and affects our views and opinions. It has a really profound psychological impact. We have a certain view of the world, a certain view of ourself, and if someone contradicts that view, how does that feel? It feels unpleasant. So the reaction is often then to defend yourself because you don't want to have that underlying feeling. So people, you know, seeking pleasant experiences can really be problematic, or trying to avoid unpleasant experiences. People become addicted to drugs. All the sexual problems are going out. You know, we got a guy that's got a sentence to 175 years in prison today out of some drive that underlying it is this pleasant, unpleasant experience. And this sense of whether things are pleasant or unpleasant is so powerful. I'm talking about a reflex reaction here. This isn't some kind of conscious act, but something's unpleasant and then there's a response to it. Or something's pleasant, there's a response to it. Maybe your body hurts. Next thing you know, you find yourself in a refrigerator, right? This reflex reaction, the Pali word is tanha, which gets translated as often as desire, but I think a better word would be craving or thirst. It's an unquenchable thirst. It's a reflex reaction. And this craving, in the Buddhist framework, is the cause of suffering. Always trying to line things up so that you get pleasant, get rid of unpleasant, and when things are neutral, you kind of stir things up. So at a very subtle level, it's, you know, we've talked about some of the sort of more serious problems like addiction to drugs or unskillful sexual activity. But there's also, you know, Vedana driving desire for power because it makes people feel good. Just huge. But beyond that, there's just this very subtle, constant activity to try and line things up so they're pleasant and get rid of the unpleasant. And I think it's such a radical and unusual view of the Buddhist tradition, which is it doesn't work because everything changes. So much of practice is to see that. So if we want to be free, at peace, we really need to learn how to work with these pleasant, unpleasant experiences. And we can't just decide, okay, well, I'm going to stop this. Wouldn't that be nice? We wouldn't have to have a center anymore. We have to really realize in an embodied way that it's not a skillful activity, that it causes stress and suffering, and that there's actually something better, something that's stable, something you can rely on. So an approach that really is kind of a fundamental aspect of the whole structure of this practice is to learn to create positive vedana, a good sense of self, and to release the stuff that causes unpleasant. And what the Buddha did, he decided, okay, well, we have more experience over mental pleasant, unpleasant experiences than we do over pleasant, unpleasant sense experiences. So we have some control over that. And I can really testify that today because I've actually got an achy body right now. I got a cold. And I just really was, you know, it's there. So are you going to make it worse or can you just be with it? That's really a challenging practice. So a lot of the teaching is to cultivate skillful mental states. Mental states that create a pleasant feeling tone. And so the Buddha has approached, I mentioned a while ago that he really focused on intention, is that we can pause and we can ask whether this intention is skillful or not. And by skillful, I mean, is this leading us to a place of being peaceful and harmony with the world, or is it leading us into addiction, something dark? So when I talk about what activates bright and dark karma, what I'm saying is this action of the heart activates bright and dark karma. What is bright and dark karma? Bright's karma that has a quality of feeling uplifted, of openness to things, of sensitivity, of being tender, a sense of joy. And dark karma is being contracted, defended, a sense of despair. So these are not moral criteria. I know Andy Olzensky is going to give a talk on integrity, but this is really about a felt sense of things. What does this lead to if we act this way? Now, it turns out we do act in a moral way if we really explore that. Because the Buddha is saying what leads to bright karma is the qualities of kindness, compassion, of renunciation. Now, renunciation doesn't ring too well here. But it's part of the problem with a lot of the translations of the Buddhist teaching. In the Buddhist culture, renunciation was a beautiful quality. It's not being dependent upon things. It's not having to have things. A sense of ease about being comfortable with the way things are. So it's not chasing around things we don't need because there's an actual level of stress in that. And so it's really helpful to look at that. So the practice is, again, pause and look at whether our intention is skillful or not. You know, if you just think about it, if you're just really kind to yourself, how does that feel versus if you start beating yourself up about things? I should try harder. I wasn't any good at it. How does it feel when you're kind to someone else? How does it feel when you deeply listen to someone? How does it feel when you speak in an authentic way as opposed to trying to puff yourself up or telling lies? This is something to investigate, to explore. So we did this in this karma and the end of karma class this fall, and one person in the class said, I really love this bright karma. Yeah, it really... not only that, kind of acting for this place of kindness and compassion, but also meditation is actually supposed to create bright results, bright karma. So if it doesn't, and I'm not saying that you don't have to deal with some difficult stuff and sit through some difficult stuff, but if it isn't leading you to a more simplified life, if it starts getting to be a project, really need to look at that. So this whole framework of the Buddhist practice is really, in tentative words, finding a way to have skillful mental behavior. The other part of the practice is to release dark patterns. Maybe all the anger, ill will, irritation, greed. And how do we do that? And this is where a lot of the Buddhist teaching kind of challenges people, because we want to fix things, get rid of things. I've had a lot of questions about anger, mostly people going through divorce. And people, well, I don't know what to do with this anger. I know I shouldn't be angry, but you are angry. And what is it that thinks you shouldn't be angry? There are mental experiences that we believe, right? There's one little program, one pattern that's angry, and there's another pattern running that's saying, you shouldn't be angry. And they battle it out. So the practice is not trying to get rid of these things. Because trying to get rid of them is a form of aversion or resistance to what's there. So what we want to do, and actually maybe just give a little framework for this, because I'm going to say a lot, and I can't imagine you remember it all, because I can't remember it all when I give it. That's why I have to have notes. But maybe pick up something useful for you. So there's a nice little framework. There's an acronym called RAIN. People know that? Okay. So it's just recognize what's going on. So recognizing there's some form of suffering or stress going on. This is seems so obvious, but it's so important. I've been dealing with this achy body for like days, and I just noticed all of a sudden, oh, yeah, you really have aversion to this. I mean, it's like you get lost in the whole activity to it. And it's not even conscious. Like, I shouldn't be resisting this unpleasant, achy body or something. But it's just feeling that you're kind of pushing it away sometimes lightens it a lot. Okay. So that's the recognized part. Know something's going on. Allow or accept. Because we can't understand anything unless we open to it. If we keep trying to get rid of it, that behavior pattern is going to be going on forever. So acceptance is a tricky word. A lot of people don't like it because it sounds like resignation. But acceptance doesn't mean resignation. It really means to receive the experience. Okay, so we recognize there's some sort of form of stress or suffering going on. We allow it to be there. And then I means to investigate it. And N means not to identify with it as what you are. Because if you think what you are an angry person, you're caught. You're lost. If you think you're a sad, a depressed person, you're lost. Because you can't really look at it. So that's the framework. Recognize, accept, investigate, and not identify with. But it's not easy to do. So a lot of practice is developing the stability, the capability, the skill set to do that. And so what we want to do is be with an experience but not lost in it. So Ajahn Sucitto, a teacher I really like, uses the phrase widening and softening. So what happens when there's some sort of difficult experience? The mind tends to contract around it. The whole world becomes that unpleasant experience. The whole world becomes this person who said something that hurts your feeling. All of a sudden, that's all the mind wants to think about. I actually remember many, many years ago, I was giving a talk, and this guy was just, his whole world was his itchy nose. I mean, that's how crazy the mind is. I mean, it was just, so the widening in part, is a mental skill. Joseph Goldstein has a phrase I love, and the sky is blue. You know? My knee hurts, my neck hurts, and the sky is blue. My feelings are hurt, and the sky is blue. There's a really beautiful poem by Mary Oliver called Wild Goose, I think, where she talks about all the stuff that's going on in the world, and we're contracted around this little thing. So widening the mind to be bigger, and also to widen our focus on the body. So that means that we try and find parts of the body that feel at least okay, maybe neutral, maybe even good. So we're trying to find enough spaciousness, enough bigness to be able to be with the experience. I always just kind of joke, my toes just, they're always fine, you know? Or maybe the buttocks or the hands. So you want to start finding these parts that feel okay. And then you can kind of come to the edge of something that's maybe difficult, but you have enough space to be with it, not lost in it. I can talk a little bit about investigation. Before I do that, though, there's a... Someone read my bio about having interest in somatic experiencing. There's a guy named Peter Levine who wrote a book, In an Unspoken Voice. He wrote a new book, which I wouldn't recommend now after having read it. But basically, a lot of these patterns are embodied. Most of them are embodied. So if we don't come to the body, allow these tensions to release, thinking won't get you there. So that's why so much of the teaching, I don't think the Buddha knew about Peter Levine at the time, but the teaching fits very much with that model, that if you want to be free, you need to open to the experience and let these patterns be released. And that might take a long time. But I really testify it works. I used to have a really defender piece. I mean, it would get into rage over... Yeah, you know, this slight stuff. And, you know, I think it's really gone now. I mean, I sat with adrenaline flowing for weeks one time on a retreat. So we widen and soften, and then we want to step back. This quality we all have, which is, you know, it's a really amazing, actually, that it doesn't get talked about. We have ability to step back and see what's going on. Step back out of the thought process and watch the thought process rather than be caught in it. Step back out and, oh, there's pain here. Or, oh, there's a sense of hurt or sadness. Rather than be lost in it, we can step back and be with it. And often instructions of dealing with these things is to be mindful. And mindfulness is a really tricky word. And again, the translation problem is mindfulness tends to make you think you should be up in the head with this stuff, right? Minding it. And it conveys a sense of observing the experience. But what we really want to do is bring this quality of sometimes observing is good, but it doesn't have a lot of sense of empathy to it. I remember when I first started practicing, a teacher said, well, it's just like mirror-like. It just sees. But really we want something more than something that just sees. We also want some empathic quality that feels. How do things feel to us? So, one thing that you can do other than just observe is to actually listen. Listen to the quality of the voice that you hear. Is it tense? Is it relaxed? Is it full of fear? Another, and probably most important is to feel in the body. What does the experience actually feel like? So let me just talk a little bit about, I've talked a little about, with, say, physical pain or emotions, is to find a part of the body that feels okay, areas where there's no pain. And that, a next step is to separate the mental response from the physical experience. So I was sitting today, body's aching, and I've done this for years. I used to ask the Joseph Goldstein, I said, do this over and over again. And I said, I'm not sure it gets me anywhere, you know. But it does. There's a skill set. So I was sitting, the body's aching, and then I noticed there's a mental reaction to it. It could be very subtle. It might not be explicit, I don't want this or something, but you can just feel some form of aversion, of pushing away. So then I can notice the mind's doing that. And sometimes just looking at the mind and seeing it's pushing something away is freeing. Sometimes you can bring what Ajahn Sucitto calls the qualities of great heart. So that might be, maybe there's a lot of pain or some emotional difficulty, and you say, may I care for this pain? Or if there's anger, may I care for this anger? Okay. There's actually a nice little practice where pick whatever emotion you want. You say, well, I'm aware there is anger. Breathing in, I'm aware there's anger. Breathing out, may I care for my anger? Then maybe the next step might be, and this is the next step of investigation, is to see that this is not self. See its ephemeral changing nature. So you could say, breathing in, I realize this is impermanent, not who I am. Bringing out, may I be at peace. Any kind of technique like that. So some of the questions, I think it comes up with anger when people are meditating or any emotion, is a thought comes up and the question then gets to be, well, now what do I do? Am I supposed to develop in calm or should I work with the difficult emotion? And there's a lot of emphasis on developing calm, but really this, what's really important, what's freeing in our daily life and what's long-term freeing, is developing some wisdom. So if you can be with the experience, if you have enough steadiness, then do that. Open to the experience the way it is. Not, oh, I got to go back to calm. I mean, if you're overwhelmed with it, you can use something like the breathing process as an anchor or the body as an anchor. Okay. But if you can be with it, then that's the way to work with it. Okay. So one reason for doing all this activity is that we release these patterns in the body. Okay. But the real core issue of this is that we start really seeing in constant unreliable nature of all these things. We just can't line it up. So we always have pleasant experiences and not have unpleasant experiences. Certainly we want to do what we can, but it's just not possible. Bodies get sick, they get tired, they get old, people hurt your feelings. So the end game of practice is to be able to be with the experience and not pushed and pulled around by it. So this is what we might call the end of karma, that the heart's not moved to get experiences and get rid of experiences. And there's something there. I said a while ago that in order to, you know, be free of this constant seeking of pleasant experiences and trying to get rid of unpleasant experiences, is there, we need to see there's something else, something that's more reliable. What we're not trying to do, trying to do things, to accomplish things, to get rid of things, there's a quality of mind that maybe one way to language it would be stillness. It's not lost in all this activity. Another way it gets languaged is there's awareness. So a lot when we practice is there's a sense of a witness for a long time, a witness observing things, a stepping back. But at some point that witness disappears. And there's just this spacious quality that's there that just allows everything to unfold just the way it is, a peace that's not dependent upon conditions. So we can have moments of this. This isn't some like you get some big bang and you're free forever. But you just might notice moments when the mind's still. It's not doing anything. The last couple of classes I taught, I had people sit around and describe what awareness was like. And, I mean, it's a profound experience. In some sense, practice can get too oriented around achieving, accomplishing, seeing change and all that. But there's something right here, right now, that's available to you. There's a quote from the Buddha, when the mind is not clinging, right, which is trying to hold on to, get rid of unpleasant, hold on to pleasant experiences, when the mind is not clinging, the mind is not agitated. When the mind is not agitated, one has personally achieved nirvana. So one moment of not clinging, not pushing away, not holding on to, is a moment of awakening. Ajahn Suchito gave a beautiful talk. I really recommend you might Google it. It's called Not Waiting for Nibbana. It's on Dharma Seed. And at one point in the talk, he quotes the Buddha as saying, everything is mine. This is one of the five remembrances, which, you know, basically, you're reflecting on the fact that you're subject to old age, sickness. Actually, maybe decay is a better word because you don't get back. I'm not going to get young again, okay? Old age, decay, and death, right? And the reflections on that, we're subject to that. And then the fourth reflection, or remembrance, is the way he languaged in his particular talk is, everything is mine, beloved and pleasing will become otherwise. That's the truth, right? And Ajahn Suchito says, so why did the Buddha say this? Is he trying to depress us? And what he says is that when the mind sees, actually, that everything breaks up, absolutely everything, it sees into its own nature, which is awareness. This still quality where the mind's not doing a thing, and it's readily available. Rodney Smith, who some of you probably heard give a talk, had this view that practice was this going to take many, many lifetimes to become free. You know, it's practice of a guy named Nisargadatta Maharaj who taught in Bombay, India. He died, I don't know, 15 years ago or so. And he was in his monk's robe, and Nisargadatta Maharaj says, so are you ready to join me in the absolute? And Rodney said, well, how do you do that? And he said, I see you're not ready. So it's something that's really right there, right now. Okay. So let me just close with the general direction of practice then again is to cultivate skillful mind states, kindness, compassion, and actually to see the results of them. And the more you see them, the more you want to behave it, to clear dark patterns. And then at some point seeing that none of this is you, everything's inconstant and reliable, stepping back from the whole process. So we really have to learn to work with unpleasant experiences. And I'll end with a quote from the Buddha, that one should here and now make an end to suffering without abandoning the underlying tendency to lust for pleasant feeling, without abolishing the underlying tendency to aversion towards painful feeling, without extirpating the underlying tendency to ignorance in regard to neutral feelings. This is impossible. So that if you want to be free, we really have to find a way to deal with pleasant, unpleasant experiences and not to phase out with neutral ones. It's core. It's the driver of craving. Okay? And that's a challenging task. But if we sort of take that as a framework rather than a framework of, I'm going to line it up so I feel good all the time. If you come to practice with that intention, you're going to be disappointed. You're going to waste a lot of time. There was actually a quote by Ajahn Sumedho. I came across it on Facebook, and actually somebody's in there I sent that quote to. He said, Buddhism isn't about being happy. Buddhism is about finding peace under all conditions. There's a great quote from Ajahn Chah that the mind itself is inherently peaceful. That it's not peaceful is because it gets tricked by moods and emotions into identifying with them. Okay, so I'll stop there and open up to questions on anything. Doesn't have to be at all related to what I talked about this evening.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.